John Fain. On radio, online and on digital. The Conversation Hour on 774 ABC Melbourne.
And on ABC Victoria.
Shortly we'll introduce you to a French writer. She's a sort of enfant terrible of French writing. She's a very hot property in the French literary scene. Her name is Marie Dariussec, and she's joined the team at Charlie Hebdo after the terrorist massacre, after the attacks, as a gesture of solidarity. And she carries a lot of literary cred with her in so doing. So she'll be our first guest joining us shortly. My co-host, Libby Gore, presents Sunday mornings on 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria, does occasional reports for ABC TV's 7:30, and has just recently been named in dispatches, recruited to a committee, I think it was, at the AFL, but I'm not absolutely sure what they do. Libby, good morning to you.
Good morning to you, Mr. Fain.
Now, I saw your name on a list of people who have been absorbed in the AFL draft, but a very different one.
Hilarious. Wonderful. 30 years, full circle. It is the AFL Advisory Committee to the establishment of the Women's AFL League competition next year, which is really quite fascinating. I attended my first so-called board meeting a couple of weeks ago.
How many are on it?
There are 10 of us on it. Really different and diverse. Someone once explained to me that with a board you want like-minded but different people. And there was a range of like-minded but very different people.
You don't want 10 people furiously agreeing with each other on everything. That's completely pointless.
But this was even more diverse than that. There were different ages, different ilks, different colours, men, women. It was my first experience of being on a board. It was really quite fascinating.
Have you never been on a board?
No. No, I haven't.
How have you escaped that?
I just probably by being an enfant terrible for most of my life.
Oh,
now
no.
I am no longer enfant. I am woman, unpredictable, but...
We'll leave that alone for the moment. There's all sorts of... It's hard being a productive member of a hard-working board. It's easy to go in there and just sort of, you know, say, oh, this is what we've got to do, but you've got to actually work with your fellow board members to achieve outcomes. It's interesting.
And this is really innovative because it's base level starting a new thing.
Yep.
And so there we were around that big AFL table and there were all the
pitches. Do you meet in the same room as the commissioners?
Yes.
What a hoot.
Alan Aylett, Jack Hamilton, you know, all of the big pictures on the board. And then there was this group of women with a couple of men scattered through, like Craig Starcevich, he was there.
Oh.
And
chocolate biscuits?
No, rice paper rolls.
Oh.
It was all much more calorie conscious.
Alcohol free?
Yep.
Okay. Tea and coffee.
Tea and coffee and herbals.
Mm-hmm.
And it was quite an extraordinary privilege to be sitting there. I've only ever had that experience once before, which was in the boardroom at Channel 9 in Sydney for the program they called The Catch Up, which was a total disaster. But it worked
kidding.
Okay for me.
So how often do you meet?
Kerry Packer. I remember having the same feeling. Like Kerry Packer would have thought, how can this group of women be sitting around the board table? Well, that's the kind of way it felt.
Okay. So how often do you meet and what powers do you have?
We meet as required. In terms
of, dear, oh dear, that's not a good sound.
Well, no, it is a good sound. We've got another meeting scheduled for next week. We have a minimum of... The season's going to start next year in February.
Mm-hmm. It's a sort of pre-season before the blokes comp.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
But, so it'll be contained and it'll just be a starting point. It's very exciting.
So do you have an ongoing role as a committee after the comp gets up and running, or do you just have to get it to the starting line?
In perpetuity.
Okay. Well, I'm sure you're not appointed in perpetuity, but for the time being at least.
No, I think that's what they said.
What, the rest of your life?
Yes.
No, I don't think so. Hey,
No, true.
What powers do you have?
We are an advisory committee, so all of the powers that go with there. But it's really quite fascinating. And it's interesting to note where the bulk of women that are playing football are, which is Western Australia. The next decision that has to be made is which teams will be part of the league from Victoria.
Because more clubs want it than you've got the capacity.
Yep. More clubs want it. So we'll have a conversation about that, I guess, to see where they're at in a couple of weeks.
So you get to give advice, not actually make the decision?
Correct.
Okay, right.
Correct. So it's feeding in from the community,
mm-hmm.
and obviously the commission will make the decisions. But I think that's a positive step.
Are you being lobbied?
No, I wish. It would be great to be lobbied, but I am thinking about it.
I'm thinking of being lobbied.
I'm thinking about inviting people to lobby me. I think that it's really quite fascinating that they're putting netball teams in football clubs.
Yeah.
And I think it's amazing that there will be female football teams coming out of these established, very male bastions, mm-hmm. the football clubs are. And whilst the league is looking at it as a business proposition, obviously, because there's a demand for it, mm-hmm. and there will now be a supply of a league in a more creative sense, I also see it as a huge marker of social change. Huge marker of social change. That women who want to play football can play football. And in this town, football is the last bastion, I would say.
We had this conversation with a friend at dinner the other night who has a precociously talented, athletic 15-year-old daughter who is an emerging star of basketball and suddenly asked at school, oh, can you help out for the girls' footy team? So she goes and plays her first ever game of football at 15 and basically stars.
Did she love it or not?
She loved it, but she runs faster than everybody else and she's more agile and she's got great hand-eye coordination and all her basketball strategy skills come into play and she's an instant fit in the footy team even though she's never, ever once played a game of football. And they're all going, you know, you can just ditch the basketball and probably start mainlining, you know, streamlining or heading towards a career, an actual lucrative career.
They're saying that to her at school.
Various people are saying, you know, footy's where the money is now. So what do you reckon? There's going to be a race for talent.
Well, that's what they did. And that was what the first 7:30 report was about. They actually held days around the country whereby they were talent spotting from other sports.
Yeah, other codes.
So if you were an established player in another sport, they invited you along. It wasn't like, well, if you're a schlepper playing in the C team of the local netball team, come. They were asking for top standard athletes. There's a Matilda, for instance, who's training with the AFL Academy. There's a girl,
the captain of the cricket team went and starred last weekend.
Yeah, so it's really interesting, the transfer of skills. And the girls love it because they get to run unbridled.
Yeah.
Straight down the wing, ponytails flying. They can be aggressive. They can be joyful. They can jump. There are no kind of constraints on their personality.
Mm-hmm.
Would I like my daughter to play AFL? Well, she does, in that she's six.
Six?
Hmm.
There's a comp. Oz kick, yeah.
But, you know, it's a big decision. Do you want your daughter to play? But the girls are loving it. So it's a very interesting push to be part of.
Oh, it's very exciting. So
Well,
it is. You have an advisory role,
but I do.
Also means that you become part of a fairly strong internal culture at the AFL as well, which is an exciting thing because they are, you know, when they set their mind to something, and we've seen this with all the charities that they support, the, you know, the breast cancer round, now the Indigenous round coming up and so on, the AFL have realised that they have corporate social responsibility at their very core and they need a licence with the community to not just put on footy games but also to
embed themselves,
reflect the community's interest in other things beyond footy.
Indeed. Have I told you that I do a wellbeing show on Sunday? Does anyone know?
Where?
Here at 774 at 10 o'clock on Sunday.
On the radio?
Yes, it's all been reshaped into fulfilment and wellbeing. Did I tell you that?
Really?
Yes, at 11:05 every Sunday we do meditation. You'd
meditation
enjoy that.
On the radio.
Meditation on the radio.
Mm,
no, we don't chant.
Don't? Oh.
We've got the very lovely Dr. Richard Chambers who takes us through meditation.
You're doing yoga on the radio.
Yeah. It's good.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Sue Becker all over again.
It's,
do you remember Sue Becker?
No.
You're probably not old enough.
No.
Sue Becker used to do exercises before the news on Channel 2.
Did she?
I think it was before the news. Was it before the news or was it earlier? I don't know. But,
Swami Sarasvati used to do yoga.
Yeah, that sort of thing.
Anyway, I think that's a... It's
calisthenics. Do you remember calisthenics?
No, I was never a calisthenics girl.
No, probably not.
Discus.
Meditation.
Yes, meditation.
How do you do meditation on the radio?
Well, there's this app called The Smiling Mind,
which
is a free app. Anyone can go there. Mm. And research has shown...
Sorry?
You should try it. It might stop that negative chatter.
Oh, right.
It might change the way you view the world.
Of course.
It might take away the monkeys on your shoulder.
Oh, what monkeys are they?
That say everything is wrong and, you know.
How do you meditate on the radio?
Well.
Without having dead air?
Well, we have a guided meditation and we make ourselves very comfortable.
Shut your eyes.
That's right. and concentrate.
Think of the tips of your fingers.
Correct.
Think of the tips of your toes.
Yes.
Feel every little tingle.
Mm.
Start on your little finger.
Yeah.
Now move to your ring finger.
That's it.
Now move to your middle finger.
Mm.
Now move to your index finger.
And it could be the most important self-care.
Think of the tip of your thumb.
That many people
move
do.
Move up to the knuckle.
Around
the first knuckle. Just up to the second
all
knuckle.
All week.
Really?
Mm. We're investing in the health and well-being of this magnificent state. And given your reach, Sean, I thought it was only fair that I share with everybody the fact that on a Sunday morning
it's
between
cross promotion
10 and 12, you can feel better.
Yeah?
Mm.
But if I
was
crass. Between when? 10 and 12. Mm. So after I've watched Jared Henderson saying things about you on Insiders.
Wasn't that fantastic?
He wasn't happy with you. Did anyone notice that? Libby Gore did a report on 7.30. Let's go back very quickly. Let's go back a step. You do occasional reports for 7.30 and you did one about the contest in Indi.
I did.
With Cathy McGowan, the sitting independent member, being challenged again by Sophie Mirabella, who she replaced in the last election.
Yes, by a handful of votes.
And?
439 or something like that.
So you went up there, interviewed them all.
I did. Well, I spent time. I guess it wasn't a proscenium interview whereby one sits down across and there are normal rules of engagement. They allowed me to visit them in their home and have a personal conversation about their lives and how they felt about what they were doing.
Yeah.
Which I understand is not strict political discourse, but it's still a valid way of meeting the character of your candidates, full stop.
And one of the questions you asked Ms. Mirabella was?
In the light of recent articles written about her as the Queen of Mean, Mark Dreyfus saying things about her in Parliament, etc. I asked her, you know, how did she feel about being perceived and portrayed as a bitch? And
her answer was?
She was fantastic. She said she felt it said more about the people calling her names than it did about who she felt she was.
And on Sunday morning on Insiders, Jared Henderson was on the couch.
I didn't call her a bitch.
No, you asked her how she felt about other people calling her that. Jared Henderson said on Sunday morning on Insiders, that your report was the...
Don't you dare
He said it was terrible. He said it was the worst thing he'd seen on television in 10 years.
I was so grateful he didn't say 20.
Demanded an investigation by the new ABC managing director into how that was allowed to go to air.
Yeah. Well, it went through all the proper channels and it went to air. And Sophie and Kath both agreed to that style of interview. And it was definitely true to its nature. There was no tricky stuff in the edit suite. And neither of them have complained about it, so it was fair.
So only Jared's complained.
Well, it seems to me.
Interesting.
There were some people who took umbrage at the fact that I mentioned that Cathy didn't have children. It's funny, John, what people hear in interviews and how it presses their own individual buttons. So there were quite a few little emails that came through to me about mentioning that Cathy didn't have children, which also was not something that I had put to her as a question. It was something that her sister had said the reason why the family co-opted Cathy was because they called her, in their words, a maiden aunt, and she had the time to do what the family felt was necessary. And so that was another really interesting thing that got emails. They're good reports, though. It's nice approaching something from an unconventional angle, a candid, authentic angle.
Libby Gore,
what,
referring to her own report, saying that they're very good on 7.30.
Well, I think they are very good because
that's
they're different.
Text messages, please stop being dismissive and ridiculing meditation. I've spent many hours as a mental health professional doing it.
That's a slap for you, John.
There are many of them. John, you could do with a bit of meditation.
That's what I
Listen
said.
In on Sunday morning, says Julie from Blackburn. You're talking out of rubbish, says Carol from Seaford, who says basketballers ask Lauren Jackson how much she gets paid in the Women's Basketball Association in America. And someone else simply says, John, have you been drinking coffee again? Libby Gore, my co-host, she presents Sunday mornings on 774 ABC Melbourne and ABC Victoria, occasionally on television on 7.30, doing occasional reports for them, and recently appointed to the advisory committee for the AFL on the establishment of a women's league. Our first guest, Marie Dariussecq, is a French novelist. She's written a book called Men, A Novel of Cinema and Desire, and there's a lot of desire in it. She's also joined Charlie Hebdo since the terrorism attacks as a gesture of solidarity with them. Marie, welcome to Melbourne.
Thank you.
Wonderful to have you here.
Thank you.
How are the people at Charlie Hebdo today? How is it internally?
It's a long story, but they are damaged. They are wounded, even if they were not physically wounded. They are... But they try to have fun and they try to go on working, but it's really hard to replace cartoonists. They lack five fabulous cartoonists. And I learned that, in fact, you can replace a writer, bizarrely enough. But a cartoonist, she or he needs to be able to draw, to know exactly what's happening in politics in France today, yesterday, tomorrow, to be able to play on words, to play on images, to know about all the clichés, blah, blah, blah. And she or he has to be funny. So it's a lot of things for one person. And for the moment, they are training other young cartoonists. And also, everybody's scared. So it's a tough time. Writers, we do have writers, but cartoonists, we lack cartoonists.
Are they inhibited now in what they do?
Inhibited? No. No, not. They are very angry. They are extremely angry. So they're not inhibited. No. They're the same. They've always been angry people. They've always been feminist, anti-racist, anti-fascist people. The image they have abroad is covered with misunderstanding. It's terrible. They are wounded also because the newspaper was never aimed to be read out of France, never designed to be read out of French language. And so the reception of the magazine, especially in the United States or in other parts of the world, is completely false, mistaken. And I did a lot of pedagogy this past year to try to explain what is Charlie Hebdo to a non-French-speaking audience. And I'm exhausted, actually. I'm very, very tired.
There's a long tradition in France, though. There's, what is it called, Le Canard Enchaîné? The Unchained Duck is a translation of another satirical, hard-hitting, it's like Private Eye in England.
There are many more cocks and pussies in Charlie Hebdo. Le Canard Enchaîné is much softer. It's less offensive than Charlie Hebdo. Charlie Hebdo is really amazing. It's like dynamite, and it has to go on.
Tell me, the actual offices of Charlie Hebdo, they're now in a secret location?
Yeah, sure. What else can they do? There are more guards and cops than journalists now there. It's horrible. It's horrible. It's a very sad place. It's a bunker. I go there not very often because it's very sad. It's very sad to be. It looks like a spaceship. It's all white and many doors and security, and it always reminds me of the threat and of the I'm a person from the 80s. I was born in a world I never thought I could die for my ideas. Really, you know, it was for Chile, you know, places like that, remote and fighting and struggling. But actually, I learned that in France, in Europe, we can die for our ideas, and it's a very new thing. We have to adapt quickly.
My understanding is you've got three children.
Mm-hmm.
Does it frighten you at all?
Of course, I'm frightened. I'm very frightened. I'm very frightened, but I'm not in first front.
Not intimidated.
As a writer, when I learned what happened on January 7th, 15. These people are Cabu, Volensky. You can't even imagine. I'm sure you have the equivalent here in Australia, but they were in their 80s, these old sweet guys drawing these silly, really silly cartoons. And I've always been knowing their cartoons. They're part of us. And the other ones were fabulous, Sharp, Tinius, etc. I didn't always agree with them, but you know, as Voltaire is supposed to have said, I will fight so that they have a right to say it. So my reaction was obvious as a writer. That's all I know. But yes, it's very scary. It's tragic. We live in tragic times.
There's an internalized anxiety, I note, that you said about living in Paris now. Everybody, this has seeped through to everybody.
I love Paris. I love it even more than before. I cherish the city. I was a bit fed up of Paris before. I was getting bored. Well, now I'm not bored. I'm just scared, but I'm not
Hang
bored.
On,
and
if
I
you're
love
bored with Paris.
Paris,
you're bored with life.
Yes, it's true. No, but it had been 25 years. I knew all the streets, etc. It's not such a big city, in fact. It's very dense, but now I love Paris.
This is an interesting book.
Because Thank you.
It's called Men, a novel of cinema and desire. And it takes all of those wonderful things that we associate with Paris, which is like desperate heart beating and romance, and mixes it up with a thread of racism and I guess the shallowness of the arts, arts like cinema. It's very Parisian in its love life, its narrative.
Oh, you have never been waiting for texts like crazy?
Oh, no? But I have. So that whole theme of waiting for men and the desperation and the coup de foudre, so to speak, is so brilliantly captured. Does this still is this something that still fascinates you, even as a grown woman in a relationship with children, the whole notion that you wait for men's affection?
Oh, even as a grown woman, I'm waiting, I got stupid, etc. No, it's... I remember, you know, again, being in the 80s and writing a letter. It took 3 days, and then you sent it, you found a stamp and an envelope, and it took 1 week, and the person received it, read it, answered. It took 3 weeks, the basic cycle. You started worrying after 3 weeks of if he or she doesn't answer. Now, after 3 minutes after a text, you start getting crazy. Why didn't she or he answer? What's happening? After an hour, you break up. You know, it's a disaster, etc.
And so, and you're online looking for someone new.
Swiping left or right, John.
The feelings are the same.
I'm told about that, Libby. I've never done it myself.
The feelings are the same than ever, than since Omer, I suppose. But the quickness, the hysterical, the paranoia, the obsession, all our neurotic aspects are increased, are sharpened by the new technologies, which are fabulous, but notre romantisme is getting a bit. We're getting different anyway, but yeah. And yes, the book is even more complex because he's black and she's white, and they are second-rank actors in Hollywood, Hollywood being the biggest factory to produce clichés, you know. And as they are second-rank actors, they are labelled all the time, and he, being black, is always either a boxer or a dealer or a cop, and she is this little tiny Parisian, always romantic.
Little doll.
Yeah, a little doll. And they are really fed up. And I think they meet on that ground of trying to, you know, get out of the glue of clichés. And their love affair starts on this very sticky ground.
Mm. I'll say it's sticky. And it becomes even more so as the novel progresses. But I'm interested to know how it intersects with your love of biography and the use of irony. Mm-hmm. With biography. And I wondered if you could explain that, because when I looked up irony, it's a word I use a lot, but I realised I don't always know completely what it means.
As a writer?
And how much of you is in this?
Solange, the character, she's me if I was not a writer, she's a big part of me. But without this knowledge, in a way, and this... this craft, this mania also of writing. So irony for me is when I build a character like Solange. I used her already. She's a recurrent character. She's quite naive. She's very frank and naive and a bit awkward, a bit of an ignorant person, but nice and brave and not stupid. And she doesn't know what she do. She doesn't know what she does. So. Irony is when the reader understands faster than she does, a bit like Nabokov did. So I like to write with the reader in a way, because the reader understands what's at stake. But my character, Solange, she doesn't. So she falls in all the traps, you know. And the reader is always a little bit... It's funny because the reader knows what's happening in a way, and she doesn't. You know what I mean? I always write this way.
But your PhD, was it in this particular area of people who write biographies?
Oh, my PhD! It's a life away. I mean, it's another life. Yeah, I was in my 20s. Yes,
but it's the same theme, isn't it? Of writing a biography and the reader understanding more about you than you do.
Not really, actually.
No?
No, it was about autobiography in France. Actually, I did a PhD because I didn't want to work. I wanted to you know, go on with my studies as late as I could because I wanted to write novels. So the only way, if I didn't want to be a teacher so too soon, was to, you know, go on with this PhD, which was... Actually, I had a depression writing it. I didn't like it at all. So I wanted to write novels.
With these racy scenes.
Well, romantic scenes, or are they racy?
No, they're racy.
What do you mean racy?
Very sexy.
Oh, thank you. Well, I hope so. Some of my books are really sexual, because sex is absolutely covered with cliché, with stereotypes, what you have to do, you know, what the techniques, etc. is horrible, like in the female magazines. But, and romanticism, I don't know, I like to play with clichés. I've always been dealing with clichés around women, around love, and Hollywood, for example, always tells you how to love, even if it's a gay couple or a couple with, I don't know, very all the sorts of couples. It's always the same way you have to love. You have to go through certain scenes, through certain stages, through certain sentences. Hollywood, you know, covers the planet with this scheme of love, and I try to, I don't know, to dynamite it, to do something else. I don't know, and I think it's funny.
And it's It's clearly something, though, that the public want. And if you look at the success of, obviously, 50 Shades of Grey and lots of others who have tried to follow in that footstep.
It's comforting to read this.
It's is that what drives it?
Those terrible books, they make you... they are so conventional and everybody's lost and in love, we try to manage. It's always new. You fall in love with somebody and you just manage, So 50 Shades of Grey or these sorts of books are manual of techniques, actually. It makes you feel, I don't know. It's horrible. There are guides, and novels are not. Novels are questions, and I never know how to answer certain questions.
It's the commodification of sex too, though, isn't it? Because
la commodification du sexe, I love it.
Yeah. look at what's happened. The internet. If you took the sexual content out of the internet, half of it would disappear. If you have a look at what people do as soon as they go online, the first thing kids do is they start looking at sex, and off
do
it
they?
Goes. It drives.
We're both appalled.
Never.
And with young children, there you go. If you didn't already know, I'm happy to be the first to tell you.
My children are looking at soccer players.
Yeah, that's what they tell you. And it is extraordinary what a driver it is. Look at it in advertising. Look at it in music. Look at it in the movies, in every form of culture.
But this is interesting because what Marie does also is use it as a seduction tool to consider bigger issues. Mm-hmm. Because the underlying issue in this book is race, isn't it? There's a racial issue. And yet it's lubricated with an attraction of sex, but it kind of brings you to actually a bigger purpose.
Solange, this character, she wants to love this man in a bubble. She wants to be outside of the world with him in a bubble. And he has a much more political mind than she has. And he keeps on reminding her that their story is political. A black man with a white woman, they have to deal with history, with a history of domination, of slavery, of violence, etc. And on a little ground, black men and women in general have a knowledge of domination. They have something to share there. It's not symmetrical, but they have something to share. Except that my Solange, she couldn't care less. She doesn't care about race. She never even thought that she was white. It's a story of a woman who discovers that she's white. She never gave a thought to it. She thought, I don't know, the planet was white or something like that. That it was like normal to be white or natural to be white. So this guy is also a problem to her. And he wants to, to adapt Conrad in the cinema, to adapt Heart of Darkness, which is like the biggest stereotypes about Africa, elephants and darkness, because he likes to play with cliché too. He's also a bit like me. So it's Solange, my Solange. She can't care less. She just wants to be in love with this guy, and that's all. But she can't. The world is much more complex. So romanticism, etc., blah, blah, blah. It doesn't really exist. You have to deal with the world, with the planet, even when you are in bed with somebody. It's already political.
And all of this coming in the context of a France, your own native country, that is as engaged in debating race. The issues of race as it's ever been. And Marine Le Pen challenging now some of the conventional political established, not cliches, but the norms.
Apparently
of French
there
politics.
Are 36% of the French population who is ready to vote for her. And I saw it rise and rise and rise. I saw her father when he was like 8%, and I saw it rise. And I'm so disorientated because as an intellectual, I tried everything I could. I tried to write
you
against them. I tried to
pig.
Have fun at them. Yeah, I had fun at Jean-Marie Le Pen as a pig, let's say, in my very first novel, etc. But France is more and more divided between people who really are in democracy, who are not racist at all, who are really the bright side of France. Really does exist. It's also a nice country, but all these people who do not have jobs, who are desperate, who are very scared of the migrants, etc., are the other part. And France is more and more divided. I'm getting pessimistic. I'm very scared for.
Time will tell. We just saw a close call in Austria between a hard right and an ex-Green, and less than a half of 1% distinguished in the Austrian election. It's quite extraordinary what's going on at the moment in Europe. We will see. Marie, thank you very much
thank
for
you.
Joining us. Congratulations. Marie Dariasek is our first guest, and we're joined now by actor and singer Ash Flanders, who's got a show coming up as part of the Melbourne Cabaret Festival that seems somehow to take a reality show and turn it into cabaret. Morning to you, Ash.
Good morning.
Now, what are you up to?
Well, I'm doing a cabaret show. It's actually all about success and winning, the idea of how you succeed in any business, in particular the entertainment business. And talking about people who are winning, people who are losing, how you judge that in any industry or a life at all. And who we celebrate and who we demonize.
And how do we? What are your perceptions of that so far?
It's a minefield, Libby. It's a minefield trying to work out who's doing it right and who's doing it wrong. And the quest to stay relevant has never been more desperate, I think. It's a really interesting time. I talk about the Real Housewives of Melbourne, about like where culture's going. I mix the personal
With Real Housewives of Melbourne.
The Real Housewives of Melbourne is a TV show.
He's pretending he
culture.
Doesn't.
Yeah. No. Yeah, it's a cultural institution.
You think that's culture?
Yeah, well it's part of pop culture for sure. It's very
just
influential.
Trash television.
Well, trash television is a big part of pop culture.
It's a small part of pop culture.
Well, it depends what circles you hang in.
Who
in my
remembers,
circles.
Who remembers what the equivalent was 2 years ago, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 20 years ago?
It was Big Brother.
It was America's Next Top Model. It was Big Brother.
There would have been 30 of them. That's one.
I watch all the stuff.
No, this is
John,
ephemera. It's disposable. It's like a lolly wrapper. You throw it away.
No, it's not.
Yes, it is.
No, it's not. The Real Housewives of franchise started in Orange County, and it is in so many cities around the world. Yeah. It mightn't be your choice of viewing, but it's definitely not a lolly wrapper.
Yeah,
it's,
I think if a lot of people are watching it. They don't make TV shows that don't make money, so a lot of people are watching
they
it.
They do.
Not
I've got
for
big
long.
News for you, Ash. In fact, Libby's been in a few of them.
Not a few of them.
Lots
and
of
the
them.
Ones that the one that I was in, may I just say, I was cast in a show. Do you watch The View, Marie?
No.
So there was a precursor of the all girl panel in Melbourne. I was talking to John about this. It was called The Catch Up. It was on Channel 9. I did it with Mia Friedman and a woman called Lisa Oldfield, who's married to David Oldfield, who is being her name is being tossed around as being a Real Housewife of Sydney, which I say is perfect.
David Oldfield
for
was
her.
A political operative,
well,
Marie,
and she is a political operative. So and that's what this is all about. It's about the politics of friendship.
Yeah, I think that show's about a lot of things. I think it's very easy to dismiss it as nothing, but these are shows that a lot of people watch. I'm telling you, John. A lot of people watch this stuff. They take it to heart. They take it very seriously. And Gina has fans. She has a perfume line now, John.
Gina who?
Gina Liano. Her perfume.
Who
Fearless.
Is she?
Oh,
available.
She's a barrister.
Yeah, she's a barrister.
Yeah, so a lot of people,
industry.
Some of them make a living and some of them
he's
don't.
He's just being naughty.
Yeah, he's being very controversial, very contrary. That's
but
very Gina
saying,
of you.
We're not actually saying that it's a huge, huge contribution in an intellectual sense to popular culture. We're just saying that it's there.
I took some inspiration from reality shows. The very first ones in France. The first one was in 2000. It was called Le Loft, The Loft. And people were living there and always under camera. You could watch them 24 hours
Big
online.
Brother.
It was
Big
the very... Okay. But I loved it because you saw all these young people getting bored. So bored. Lying on their bed, doing absolutely nothing. And they couldn't have a phone. And they didn't even have books, which was to me horrible. So they had to love each other, to fight with each other, etc. It's completely sadistic.
Yeah, it's exploitation.
But they got so bored. It was very interesting to watch somebody being bored. I like boredom very much. I think it's very interesting for the mind.
You should be an actor. There's a lot of boredom.
Yeah, I heard about that. But my novel is about actors getting bored, yes, and falling in love. But yeah, waiting and waiting. I found it very interesting on the screen.
Mm. Yeah, I think it's that idea of like one day we'll just watch the people watching TV, and that's how Gogglebox came about.
It's
now
really
it literally is like the whole of culture has gone into the television.
Yeah, but then that becomes, once the novelty of that wears off, then that's gone too. And what do you do then?
I don't know. Where that's exciting to me. Where will we go then? Like, where is the bottom of the bar, John?
Oh,
how low can we go?
Watch people playing with their phones as a TV show. Is that the idea?
Well, yeah.
No,
I mean,
wonder
like,
television's dying as a form of expression.
Well, now people
that's
like
Q&A is, isn't it? People are playing with their phones
it's
and
just
commenting
talk back
as
television.
It goes through.
Yeah,
it's just talk
kids
back
like
TV.
Watching other people play video games now. That's a huge industry
bizarre,
where you just
yes.
watch other people mm-hmm, play a video mm-hmm. game. You don't even play the game. You just watch them play the game.
Mm-hmm.
It's
can
like
I
the age of the spectator.
About your show.
Yes, my show is all about essentially how do you find a platform nowadays if you're a creative person, a writer and a performer, when culture is going down this way where things like we're deliberately going into the abyss and things are getting more and more banal. How do you find that interesting or how do you succeed in that world where success seems to mean you have to sell out all your values and morals and become completely exploited on television.
But
now I'm going to turn it full circle on you. Don't you go to meditation? Isn't that the mm-hmm. antidote?
Only we go to meditation
reconcile
on
those
Sunday
two.
At 5 minutes
oh,
past
okay.
11.
So we indulge in all this trash the rest of the week and then pretend that it's all fixed by a bit of meditation on Sunday morning?
No.
That's a completely mischievous. That is a completely mischievous confluence of two completely different conversations.
You're calling me mischievous.
I am. I'm saying you've been hanging out with our friend a little bit too long.
I'm flattered.
It's
no, you've got to be consistent all the way through. Surely you don't just do that in little bursts.
We contain multitudes, John. We are not all one thing. We are not always all meditating. My boyfriend's a hairdresser. He went to Thailand, became a monk for a month, shaved off his hair and eyebrows and took arms and all of that. But now he loves The Real Housewives. Like, you can love television and shave off your head and live in a monastery.
From being a monk
to
engaging in The Real Housewives of Melbourne.
Yeah, he came back and realised he really liked television. That was his nirvana, was realising he loved television.
But isn't this the point, that human beings are multifaceted and flawed and that we're not consistent, Marie? Isn't that what you've also tried to point out?
I don't know. All I know is that psychoanalysis saved my life and my brain when I was in my 20s, and that I became more consistent, and that at some point you need it. If not, you just blow apart at some point, and you can either have a depression or commit suicide or blah, blah, blah. I mean, talking to somebody on a couch for twice a year, come on, a week, about your confusion helps you. But you can also be a monk and feel very consistent and then switch to something else. But you have to be very strong, I think, inside. You have to have a very strong inner life.
Sorry, did you say consistent? You can be a monk and then you can be caught up in reality television, but you have to be consistent.
If you know what you do.
You just said that,
Marie.
If you
know what you do. If you know why you do it. I mean, to me, it's a little bit bizarre, but why not? If he has a really strong inner life, I don't know.
I think the more you push one way, the pullback is going to swing you the other way. I think you see that in everything. That's why the most homophobic, horrible people are secretly gay. That's why, like, the more you go down one path, you have to snap back. The more you repress someone, the more they're going to have to be... That's why when gay guys come out a lot of the time, they become, like, huge gay stereotypes. I certainly did. I'm waiting for it to die off. But you have that because you've been so repressed for so long that you have to go too far the other way. And then you calm down and find middle ground where you can chant and then watch Real Housewives.
Or is that one of the clichés that Marie likes to send up in her book?
Yeah, I always work with clichés. But
I love clichés.
Yeah, but they are also horrible. So I take them, you know, I lift them like stones and see what's under them. But very often what's under them, it's just, you know, crawling. It's bad. But
the politics of the cliché is always very interesting. I do work in theatre where I examine genres, mm-hmm. and when you examine the people that are left out of a story in a narrative, that's often really interesting.
Mm. To paraphrase George W. Bush, why don't the French get their own word for cliché?
Hey, Ash.
Stereotype. Who wrote that for him?
I have a question. Yeah. We were talking about love and desire before. I was asking Marie if it's just women that wait for men. Do men wait for men with the whole texting thing as well?
Oh, God. No, I've never been a very good game player. I put everything... I once, apparently, I forgot this, went to someone's house, took off all my clothes and said, are we doing this or not?
Well, you don't remember?
I don't really remember.
That's possibly why you did it.
That was my 20s. It's a long time ago.
I think girls, in spite of my feminist attempts to raise my kids the same, my son and my two daughters, I think, alas, the weight of society, media, schools, etc., is very heavy on a girl, and they have a sleeping beauty in their mind.
Oh.
And even I have a sleeping beauty. I'm 47. I should wake up, but I'm still waiting.
Wake up, buddy.
Yeah. But I'm still waiting for a man so that my life starts. You know, of course, my life has already started, blah, blah, blah. But this sleeping beauty is very powerful in her sleep and in her dream. And she waits to be woken up by a man. And if you remember the old tale, during, you know, Sleeping Beauty sleeps and sleeps and sleeps, and the prince is on his horse and he fights in the forest with his sword. He's very active, you know. Wow, that's a fabulous example. And I wrote a tale in the reverse, you know, the guy is sleeping and the princess is on her horse and blah, blah, blah. But it's very hard to fight against stereotypes so deep anchored in our psyche.
What's her name? Gillian, the one from The X-Files, David Duchovny.
Gillian Anderson.
So she's put her hand up to play James Bond.
Great.
In the new James Bond franchise. And I was trying to work out when I read that whether or not she would be as promiscuous as James Bond is, and how men would feel about watching a woman cut a swath through their male hood the way James Bond has done so in the past. Mm-hmm. Sorry, John.
And being as silly.
I'd be into that, but I champion the outsider. It's just something I do.
Is
there's lots of female superheroes, and some of them
But the sex lives of females superheroes.
Yeah, some of them. I'm trying to think of the TV series on Netflix based on the comic. Oh, what's her name? Can't remember.
Yeah, not Wonder Woman?
No, another one.
Another one of those trashy shows that you like to watch?
No, it's really good. It wasn't trashy at all. It wasn't a reality. I can't bear reality television because it's not real. It's completely, that's that whole complete paradox. It's rubbish.
But artifice is interesting.
I'd rather go out and water the garden or take the dog for a walk or do anything. Go and tinker in the shed, anything. It's just such a waste of time.
I'd rather watch someone watch The Real Housewives than set foot in a garden and garden.
Actually, I quitted watching those shows, but in the thousand, I was stuck with my kids at home and I watched TV like a housewife. And now I'm free. Now I'm much more free and I don't watch this. And I walk the dog and I garden. Yes.
It's a very gay culture thing. So what gay culture has always done is taken what society considers trash and make it interesting and say, actually, this is really important.
It's a housewife
important.
Culture really, too.
Yeah, it's like that's what the definition of camp is taking things that other people say is meaningless and going, actually, this is the most fabulous, really interesting, valid thing. And a lot of the time you see the real message underneath the thing. I mean, Real Housewives, for example, is all about female competition. And that's fascinating to watch, even though it's like done in a very dynasty-esque way that we're used to with catfights and name-calling.
Contrived,
it's still fascinating.
All of it contrived.
Absolutely.
And confected and made up for the edit suite.
Absolutely. Yeah. But if you're aware of that, you can still enjoy it.
Can you still win? Like on stage, Ash, you are winning big time. You're the it boy.
You know me, yes.
I do. But yes. Is that the same when you take being yourself and being the same person on stage as you are off stage? Do you feel in a position whereby you can win at life?
No, I don't. Not
so
very much.
It's a bubble. So
yeah,
the stage is a bubble for you.
That's actually a point that I get to in the show is that, like, effectively the way to win is to just keep holding people hostage in a room and making them watch your show because when you're there, you're God and you control everything. I think that's psychologically, that's probably what's going on with a lot of performers. We all feel so powerless in our day-to-day lives. It's nice to go to work and know what I'm going to say and do and hopefully
and be acknowledged.
Communicate to people. Yeah, and be acknowledged, but hopefully it's also somehow an act of service and you are informing people or inspiring people or lighting some sort of fire under them. My shows are pretty angry as well as funny, so I hope I get a rise out of people and make them think a little.
As well as making a living and having fun.
Making a living is so low on my priorities if you look at my life choices.
I've got 50 people sending me text messages, and thank you all. Jessica Jones is the title of the Netflix show about the comic superhero woman that's been put to a very compelling drama, I might say, and she's pretty out there. She's pretty sassy.
What's her superpower?
Watch the show. It's pretty special, actually. And there are, I've got, I don't know how many people, there's 32 a screen, so there's a screen and a half of them. Other people referring to Helen Mirren in Prime Suspect and all sorts of others as well. Bring on a female Jane Bond, says yes. Brendan. Very good. Yeah. Okay, why not? So there we go. Can't recommend Jessica Jones enough, actually, but there you go.
Well, I might have to write that one down then.
Ash Flanders, as he says, he's a cliche, an actor, a writer, and a singer. You said it.
I'm a proud cliche. Look at my business card.
You said it. So is it on your business card?
I can't afford a business card.
You
would.
Played Hedda Gabler.
Yes, I did.
So, I mean, Ash is doing some really brave things in terms of reclaiming narratives.
Yeah. And exploring the worlds between genders and looking under what the story is really saying about people who aren't in the story.
Where did you go to school?
I went to Sandringham Secondary College.
Mr. Taylor, the drama teacher?
Yes. Oh, my God, hi.
Mr. Taylor, the drama teacher, says he's proud of you. Say hello to him.
Oh, hi, Dr. Dave.
All right, okay. Ash Flanders' show is part of the Melbourne Cabaret Festival. It's called Ash Flanders Playing to Win, and it's at Chapel Off Chapel. Good on you, Ash. Ash Flanders. Marie Dariasek is the French novelist. Her book, Men, A Novel of Cinema and Desire, brings her to the studio. She's also joined the staff of Charlie Hebdo since the massacre. Libby Gore, my co-host on The Conversation Hour. It's been a fascinating exploration of these issues. Sodom and Gomorrah, bring it on.
What did you call me?
No, I didn't.
It's not illegal anymore. It's all been expunged.
Yeah, that's right. Thank you for coming in on 774
ABC Melbourne.
The Conversation Hour podcasts are available at abc.net.au/Melbourne. Subscribe now and you'll receive automatic updates with special guests, interesting interviews. It's a bit of fun. You'll be mad not to subscribe. abc.net.au/Melbourne.